So Manasa just got word that a very dear friend she grew up with, just one of her best friends, she was in a bicycle accident in India, and she's been taken to the hospital. Her name is Rohini, and Rohini's condition is pretty critical. It's looking like she probably will not survive. She's in God's hands. I'm just talking about Rohini. God's in control. He's the one who has authority and power. We're not. So we can make our appeal to him. We'll trust he'll do what he sees fit. But we want to take a moment before we get into our class to pray for Rohini. Our God and our Father, thank you for hearing us, your little children. We're hurting now. Manasa's hurting for her friend Rohini. And we ache in a way that is hard to put into words. Shocking news like this is far too common. But when it happens to us, Father, we're surprised. You know Rohini's condition, and you know just what she needs. Please bless her and help her to be at peace with you and to take comfort in your care. Be with the doctors and others who are watching over her and trying to help her. If it be your will, please heal her. We're scared for her. We hurt for Manasa. But we're also looking to the joy and the hope that is ours in Christ, and the hope that we have, though we suffer, we know the plans that you have for us for the future. Help us not to lose sight of that. And to take stock of our own lives, that such devastating news can come to any of us. Our lives are frail. Our strength is small. But we serve a good and kind God. And we're going to trust you with the outcome of Rohini's injuries. But please bless her and be with her family, be with her friends who are there, and especially watch over Manasa, who's so far away, and feeling helpless and overwhelmed. Even if we were there, if Manasa were there, there's nothing that we could do but to be so far removed, Father. It's painful. And please help us to be a blessing to her, to comfort her, and to listen and to hurt with her. We're all one in this. Thank you for hearing our prayers, and thank you for Jesus, who is the answer to each of our requests. It's in his name we pray. Amen. Amen. All right. We are in Deuteronomy chapter 21, and we're just going to make our progress here through 23. I don't have handouts for you for next Sunday, because next Sunday you may not be studying Deuteronomy. I'm going to confirm with Justin, but there'll be another class. So there'll be a class with women, but we won't be here. Deuteronomy 21, there's been some instruction already in 20 and 21 about warfare and what they're to do. We've made it through 20 verse 9, so I'd like to look at 21 verses 10 through 14. And if you look up for volunteering, you can read 10 through 14. Not you, you're holding a baby. Unless you want to. All right, Mike, surrogate reading. Go ahead, Mike.
When you go out to battle against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands, and you take them away captive, and see among the captives a beautiful woman, and a desire for her, and have a desire for her, and would take her as a wife for yourself, and you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. She shall also sell her for money, and shall not mistreat her, because you have humbled him.
All right, so this is rules about marrying a foreign woman, gone out against your enemies, and as a result of last Sunday's discussion, I'm actually kind of in question of, it seems like these may not be the women of the land, from chapter 20, but maybe women who are caught in warring countries around. Either way, she's not an Israelite. And so a man says, I want to marry her. What's the condition?
Shave her head, cut her nails.
All right, so you find her really attractive. And so first thing, she's going to get a haircut and have her nails trimmed. What's going on here exactly? Why would you do that to a woman? Joanna, you want a haircut like this? No? Lyndon? Okay. Noah?
This coupled with the time span that added on that, maybe give me time to think about this. A lot of time to respond quickly to our hearts and not as much to our, you know.
Maybe respond to our hearts and maybe respond to what else? Maybe our fleshly desires.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that if you go for a shorter haircut, that's, you know, not attractive in some way. But I think the idea is this man is attracted to her outward beauty. Take Samson. Remember Samson in Judges? And he goes down and sees a woman from the Philistines and says, Dad, found a girl. Go get her for me, for my wife. Well, I'm sure he was just super attracted to her character and to, you know, her great intellect. She was a wonderful conversation. That's just not typical for Samson. Samson's just, I see, I want, I take. That's just Samson. And so I think in this case, it is meant to kind of slow down that fleshly appetite. And he's not to take this lightly. Marrying a foreign woman, God has warned his people about this before. What are some of the consequences probably?
Heart away from God.
Yeah, it happened to Solomon, right? His heart was led astray marrying these foreign women. Maybe she's an influence on him. And so now he gets a chance to reconsider this. So he marries her. Takes her, is going to marry her. But if during this process he determines, you know what, I changed my mind, verse 14, what's he to do?
Let her go.
Just let her go. So she's not yours as a slave. You know, you're not to take possession of her in this way and sell her for money. She's a person. So there's a kind of respect here. Now, we may look at this and say, wow, but that doesn't sound like respect. You're shaving her head and cutting her nails and taking away all her outward beauty. Try to see it culturally. The way civilizations back during this time would have seen this. You see a woman from another nation, you just take her. She's yours. And here, God is allowing a different process here that's going to protect her from abuse.
The paring of the nails, is that like cutting off all of the nail or just some of the nail? Like trimming your nails like
today? Yeah, just trimming them down, I would assume. I mean, I didn't think about removing, not to torture her. That would be, yeah, just, I don't know. Do most ladies keep their nails long? I don't. You play guitar some, right? So you don't have the, yeah. Now, if you finger pick. All right, Noah?
In the world in general, the capture of women and children is seen as booty, as loot.
Yeah, spoil,
and
plunder.
As objects that you sell and you, you know, play with. Here, God tells them treat them like they're humans.
Yes, yes. In Judges chapter 5, they had thought there would be wombs, women, you know, for the victors. This is the Canaanites who come in, and there's a picture of Jabin's mother kind of waiting to see if they're going to come back for more or not. And he's like, well, surely he's just, you know, he's been delayed because he found a bunch of women. And so, exactly right. And so this is the opposite of that. This is actually show respect for her, protect her, and then also make sure that you know what you're getting into with this. All right. Any other thoughts? No?
This is a bit of a side thing, but I think something that I think is really cool is that in the lineage of Jesus,
oh, yeah.
they're not all pure Jews. Some of them are, there's women that are from, and people that I think they are from other, outside of.
Right. Yeah. Take Boaz, for example. Boaz, remember who Boaz's mother is? Rahab. Rahab is Boaz's mom. So that makes Boaz half Canaanite, half Gentile. And Ruth, his wife, is Moabite, which makes Obed three-quarter Gentile, one-quarter Jew. And that's the ancestor of Jesus. So, yeah.
I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I think it is too. And it shows, well, it shows a lot of things, but yeah. Okay, David?
Just to confirm the timeline of things. So it's after that that month, you know, he makes the decision, you know, take her as the wife or let her go. Let
yes, her go. I think it's not, I don't think it's correct here in verse 14. After a month, you marry her, and then you say, yeah, I don't know about this, and then you leave her. We'll see more of that later in 24. I think it's at that moment you decide, you want her or not. Yeah. All right, glad you came for that discussion today, right? Modern applications for this.
Just a question. Do you think that there's circumcision as part of, if someone wants to become a Jew, circumcision for a man, is this anything like a circumcision for a woman? Just why the cutting of the hair, why the trimming of the, there's a, is it a leaving off of something? We see that the cutting of the hair whenever there's a cleansing of someone, I guess, in like leprosy.
Sure.
If someone is cleansed of their leprosy, you completely shave them.
Yeah.
So is this idea you're coming out of another culture and there's this cleansing that you're going through?
I had not considered that. I just assumed, and maybe wrongly assumed, that it had to do more with what appealed to him to marry her in the first place. Perhaps there's something of that. I don't know if we say it's like circumcision necessarily, but certainly the cleansing makes sense. I don't know. Other thoughts on that? Link?
There's a school of thought that says it humbles her. She's purified. She cuts off her hair. Take off her clothes or change her clothes, and then she becomes a member of that particular community.
So maybe she's leaving behind her identity in that sense. Yeah, perhaps that's part of it. In verse 14 certainly says, you have humiliated her. And think about a husband now. You're going to try to win the heart of your new wife after you have forced her to go through with this thing. There's going to be some work to do here. So I don't know what all is involved here. I'll just admit that. So you're throwing in some things I had not thought about. That's good. I don't know. This looks like, okay, well, that's just them, Israelites then, but applications you would see here for us today. Abby, you're working on something.
What my first thought is just like putting on a new self. So whenever that's just where my mind went is, you know, when become a Christian and just in general, putting on that new self. So just the sense of change, you know, not internal change, but external change too.
I thought something similar. The change thing is a new piece for me. I thought, who is the foreign bride being brought in? And if all this points to Jesus, isn't that us? Aren't we the unclean being brought in and offered marriage? And isn't there a process of humility that we need to go through in this? I like the cleansing, new man picture here too. I've not thought of that. That's a new piece for me. Amy, you have a hint?
No, okay.
Noah?
There's a scripture that comes to mind, kind of related, in my mind, related to this. Above all, guard your heart, for it's the wellspring of life.
Mm-hmm. Proverbs 4:20.
Modern application is that has been something that has really served me well, I think. You know, just watch out who you let your heart get attached to.
Yeah, Proverbs 4:23 is making that point. And whether that's in our relationships or in our desires or ambitions, it's out of my desires and my will that my life is going to be determined. So, go ahead, Amy. No, please. I'm segueing. Go for it.
Kind of looking at it the other way, I think that there is a sympathy to, as a woman, if we're going to be in that vulnerable submission relationship, I want to
I thought that was my first application, but it was from the man's side of things. I thought, you know, am I just looking for appearance's sake? But from the other side of things, that's a helpful idea. Am I, okay, this person's attracted to me, but are they attracted to me or just what I look like? Because 5 years, 10 years, 15, I am not going to look the same. You know, it changes. So that is, be thoughtful about what God sees. 1 Peter 3 talks about what the beauty that God sees in verses 1 through 6. There's an imperishable quality that he's looking for. Are we attracted to the same kinds of things? Are we looking only surface level? That's good. Okay. Let's look at this next section, 15 through 17. If a man has two wives, the one loved and the other unloved, like that would ever happen. And both the loved and the unloved have borne him children, and if the firstborn son belongs to the unloved, then on the day when he assigns his possessions as an inheritance to his sons, he may not treat the son of the loved as the firstborn in preference to the son of the unloved, who is the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the unloved, by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the first fruits of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. So, in general, just stay away from multiple marriages. That'll solve a lot of this. But in the situation where a man has multiple wives, multiple children, firstborn. Can you think of a scenario where maybe this was a problem? Yeah, Jacob and Esau. I always say Jacob and Esau, but Esau and Jacob, right? There, God had prophesied otherwise. There's kind of an interesting reversal. Other situations. What about
Israel's children.
I'm sorry, did you say Israel? Yeah, Israel's children. Yeah, Jacob's children. Who got the firstborn rights among Jacob's children? Who got the double portion? Joseph did. Reuben's the firstborn. But who is the favorite wife? Jacob has four wives, right? You have Jacob and Leah, and then Bilhah, Zilpah. And Jacob is... Did I say Jacob and Leah? Rachel and Leah. Rachel's the favorite wife, and so her firstborn is Joseph. But he is not he's like younger by 7 years at least. Okay. Go ahead. Joseph gets the double portion. We see that in the tribes. Remember Joseph, he has two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. No, wait a minute, Ephraim and Manasseh. Who gets the firstborn rights there? Ephraim, but he's the second. So God is choosing and making choices. But then he sets down a standard and says, here's what you're going to do. What about Abraham? Who's the firstborn?
Isaac.
Ishmael. Ishmael's the firstborn. But then later, doesn't he say, hey, Abraham, why don't you take your son, your only son? Okay, so God's changed things. God has the right to do that, and he's showing a reversal. He's showing his sovereign ability to choose. Romans 9 through 11 kind of highlights that idea. But here he's setting on a standard. I think this is super helpful. When it's just fair, it's fair. You don't have to sit and contemplate relationships and bias, and this just takes things out of our hands. It's just simply not permitted to practice favoritism and bias amongst your family. The oldest, you just have to trust, well, God made him the oldest. He's dumb as a box of rocks, but he gets my stuff. And so you just pass it along. That was. I'd said that before I was thinking. Smart guy. But you don't think, well, you know, okay, I trust that God's doing what he wants to in my family, and so there it is. And suddenly you're laughing. You're investing in these children because they're the ones that God's given you. And so you invest in God's choice, not in your own wisdom. Okay, I think that's helpful. Other thoughts through verse 17? Anybody want to counsel my son now? Okay, 18 through 21. Get a volunteer. David, would you read 18 through 21?
If a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, which will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and that, when they have chastened him, will not hearken unto them, then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him and bring him out unto the elders of the city, and unto the gate of his place. They shall say unto the elders of his city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. And all the men of his city shall stone him with stones that he die. So shalt thou put evil away from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear.
All right, again, we get the repetition of putting the evil away, purging the evil from your midst. We noted 1 Corinthians 5, it's a similar idea. The point is that the nation, the community of God's people, be holy. That's got to happen. This is startling, though. This particular instruction, a mother and father, they've got a son, and what is he? He's rebellious, stubborn. What else is he? Okay, that kind of qualifies us a little bit, doesn't it? He's a glutton and a drunkard, and he's rebellious and stubborn and won't obey us. What are you seeing with this son? Like, age? He's not a 5-year-old son who's learning to obey, okay? He's not a 14-year-old boy who refuses to clean his room. I don't know too many 14-year-olds that are gluttons and drunkards. I'm not saying it's out of the realm of possibility, but we're talking about a grown individual who is responsible for his choices. However, it also says that here's a son and he does not do what?
Obey.
He doesn't obey. So are we talking about a 40, 45, 50-year-old man? I don't think so. We're talking about a young man who's still under the authority of his parents, but he has rejected their instruction and teaching, and so he is turning into this. Okay. So as a parent, you see this instruction. As a kid, you see this instruction. And what's your response?
Better obey mom and dad.
Okay, that's perfect. All right, good. As a parent, you see this instruction. What are your thoughts?
It's a big responsibility. Like, I need to be on top of this from the jump, so we don't get behind the eight ball here.
Yeah.
Because, like, clearly a lot of time has passed, and, like, time's up. There's only so much you can do at that stage of the game.
We're raising our children to be contributing members of society. Gluttony, drunkard, is all about self-pleasure. It's all about satisfaction of my wants and my desires, and I'm not giving, I'm just taking. So how old does a child need to be before you start teaching them to respond to your authority? As soon as you start seeing them rejecting your authority, you start seeing it. Before they even have words, you can begin to see, oh, they're arching their back, they're crying, and then you begin to discern between cries for hunger, for sleep, for pain, and for, I'm not getting what I want. Because you know what starts off with, I'm not getting what I want, and what looks like in a 16-year-old and a 17-year-old? It's ugly. It's really ugly. And when your society's full of that kind of people, it just gets worse and worse and worse. Amos had a hand in the Noah. That's an excellent question. I would hope they'd like their son, but you know, sometimes maybe you don't. But here, does God condition it with, but if he's a pretty enjoyable guy, if he's a lot of fun when he's drunk, if he's great at parties, he makes a lot of jokes when we're all sitting around the banquet room eating, then don't worry about it? No conditions put on this. No.
But let's play this up against the background of the prodigal son. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you lay those two side by side, because the father obviously doesn't take him out and have him stoned. As far as him being a drunkard, and it says that he went out and partied, basically. So that's saying something about the nature of that particular son.
Yeah.
I think it puts another shade of understanding on this.
Yeah, take what Meredith was saying. You don't want to get behind the eight ball. You want to be proactive. But also when you start to see rebellion, you start to see your children going off, you just say, well, I guess, you know, the first time they came home drunk, better take them out to the elders tomorrow. You get to work, and you start working. There's hope. So this father in Luke 15, I think, is a great example. He goes out, and every day he's looking, he's looking, he's looking. He doesn't go chasing after him, but he's looking. So is there room between this understanding they're slipping into rebellion and taking him out and stoning him? I think so. But if we just never make a moment where we say, look, I like this guy, I can't take him out and stone him. Now we're the ones in rebellion. I'm rebelling against God and this law. So I think we can understand there's maybe some room for when is that moment? But there's got to be a moment. Okay. Lee?
I think you hit the nail on the head. To me, it's more societal than it is family oriented. If you had a whole society, though, 18, 19, 20 year olds who were rebellious and drunk and won't listen, what would that do to the society?
And to think about what that kind of nation would say to the world about the God they serve. Yeah, David.
And I think, like, when thinking about this compared to the prodigal son, just one thought I have is that in this scenario in Deuteronomy, the son's character, especially considering the context of the time, you know, he has a heart of and mind of someone who's living for himself, and mm-hmm. so. You know, and he's at the age where he can do things, you know, and so he might, you know, make decisions and do quite a number of things that had an adverse impact on the society. Whereas with one thing that I see with the prodigal son is that the son sort of, he went off, he left his father's house, and he was not in that area, so he wasn't there to cause destruction. He goes out and falls into his own destruction and comes back.
So he's not under his father's authority in that case.
Right.
That may be the case
right.
here. But you still see, and this is not different what you're saying, verse 18, though they discipline him, I think your point is right. I've got this child, they're not obeying. I've got an opportunity to discipline, and I want to train and help. Discipline's not always corrective. Sometimes it's preventative. It's helpful. So how do I help this person? But you're right, this son is outside the house.
If they don't want help and that nothing can be done, you know, they might do something, you know, I guess like with God's wisdom and foresight, you know, he's trying to prevent, you know, these types of people who are way out of control from really causing destruction within Israel that's trying to go into the land and, you know.
Yeah, let me recommend this, because we will see in chapter 22, what is to happen to a man who is found to be lying with the wife of another man?
Killed.
Be killed. What did God do with David when he sinned with Bathsheba? Was a death necessary? Who died? The baby died. Was that just? On one hand, yes. God made sure, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, that happened, and David bore the consequences of that through the death of his son. There was a death that occurred. But we also see grace there. God forgives. And Nathan says to David, God forgives your sin. Nevertheless, there are consequences. And I think we'll often look for exceptions. Let me just heartily recommend, let me encourage that we're not showing grace when we don't do what God says. We've got to be very thoughtful about what has God told us to do. So like 1 Corinthians 5, this example where here's a brother, they've sinned, and they're not repenting, and it's obvious, and we'll think, well, I'll be gracious, and we'll put up with it for a while. But we can be gracious, and we can work with this brother, and we can try to teach them, help them, counsel them, but if they continue to reject God's truth, we're not doing them any favors. We're not being gracious by ignoring the sin and allowing it to continue. It's truth and grace. John 1. With Moses came the law, with Jesus came truth and grace. And you can't have grace without truth. And so we can't just say, well, I want to be forgiving and loving and merciful. We can't be loving and forgiving and merciful if we're not obeying the God who is loving, forgiving, and merciful. So we've got to trust him. So there may be occasions to practice some discernment. We want to make sure that we're doing it the way God said to do it. All right, Amos, and then we'll move on. Like they picked up stones, and he says, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa! I'm sober now." So what do you mean? Like they take care of the elders, and then he says, "I'm going to change."
No, before that, he shows. So first, he's rebellious, and then he acts in a different way after he knows that they know he's acting rebellious.
Well, then praise God, you've got a repentant son, and you. you can make some forward movement here. Let's look at 22 through 20, to the end of the chapter here. If a man has committed a crime punishable by death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain all night on the tree. You shall bury him the same day, for a hanged man is cursed by God. You shall not defile your land the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance. All right. So there are some reasonable punishments that come with certain crimes. But here, this person, they're hanging on a tree. What do you do with the body now?
Don't leave it there.
Why would you even think about leaving it there?
As an example, a lot of times, Jesus died on a tree.
Yes. Of course, this is pointing to what's going to come
right.
later.
But he dies under a curse.
Jesus is cursed.
Yeah.
He receives the curse of God. He receives the punishment of the curse of sin. Can you think of any occasions in the Bible where someone is hanged up and just kind of, like the body's just left? Judas's body apparently is hanged, and Matthew records that he's hanging, and Luke records that then it falls headlong and bursts open, so apparently it's left there to rot. Okay, not a good thing. Cursed, right? Amos? Haman's 10 sons, right? Haman is impaled on a stake, 70 feet high, and then his 10 sons are taken out, and they're killed one day, and then Esther says, by the way, can we hang up those bodies? And King's like, yeah, here's your signet ring. And hang them up. And so they are hanged. By the way, when his body's being hanged, it's hanged, not hung. I don't know why, but that's just grammatically what it is. So they're not hung, they're hanged. And so they're hanged up just as a warning, as an example. Later with the Gibeonites, Israel had made a covenant with the Gibeonites that they were not to harm them, and then later Saul, like a couple hundred years later, ends up killing some Gibeonites, breaking that covenant agreement, and a curse comes upon the people during David's reign. And David says, what do we do? And God says, I want you to take these sons of Saul out, hang them up. And so part of that is just it's invoking the curse. Again, you get this lex talionis idea, this law of the tooth, the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. God's about justice. But the land was meant to be a blessed land, not a cursed land. So you don't want people walking through and saying, oh, there's a pirate, just hanging on the, you know, the thing. And they're like, oh, cursed be all the pirates. You know, don't be a pirate. Well, people come into the land, they're meant to see milk and honey and joy and love and faithfulness. And that's what's supposed to be in the land, not all these executions with death hanging about. Blessing, not cursing. All right. Thoughts of, through the end of the chapter here, this idea of curse on the tree. So did Jesus become a curse for us? He did. I don't think you can get around that. 2 Corinthians talks about that. He received the curse of death on our account. He became sin who knew no sin. Jesus was not a sinner, but he suffered that death for our sake. Okay, chapter 22, 1 through 12. Get a volunteer to read 1 through 12. Thanks.
You shall not see your countryman's ox or his sheep straying away and avoid them. You shall certainly bring them back to your countryman. And if your countryman is not near you, or if you do not know him, then you shall bring it to your house, and it shall remain with you until your countryman looks for it, then you shall restore it to him. You shall also do this with his donkey, and you shall do the same with his garment, and you shall do likewise with any lost property of your countryman, which has been lost by him and you have found. You are not allowed to avoid them. You shall not see your countryman's donkey or his ox fallen down on the road and avoid them. You shall certainly help them raise them up. A woman shall not wear a man's clothing, nor shall a man put on a woman's clothing, for whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord your God. If you happen to come upon a bird's nest along the way in any tree or on the ground with young ones or eggs in it, and the mother sits on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall certainly let the mother go, but the young you may take for yourself, in order that it may go well for you, and that you may prolong your days.
Through 12, please.
When you build a new house, you shall make a parapet for your roof, so that you will not bring guilt or bloodshed on your house if anyone falls from it. You shall not sow your vineyard with two kinds of seed, otherwise all the produce of the seed which you have sown and yielded in the vineyard will be forfeit to the sanctuary. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. You shall not wear a material of woolen, wool and linen combined together. You
All right, thank you. So 1 through 4 seems pretty straightforward. Got a neighbor, ox, donkey, see somebody wandering along, and like, who do you belong to, big fella? What do?
Take it to the neighbor.
You help him out, right? So principle, what's the principle here? Yeah, be a good neighbor. You got neighbors? I don't know. You think of any good applications to make from this? Plenty, okay? There are lots of opportunities to practice this kind of thing. We're not under this law today, but I think the principle is still pretty good. You know, love your neighbor as you love yourself, okay? Lee?
I was going to say, where I live, when UPS comes, I grab my neighbor's package.
Oh, man, you do what? Somebody took your package, man.
You know what I'm saying? Retailers.
Yes, yeah.
Problem.
I think, Grace, you were saying some of your neighbors. That's fantastic. That's the way it ought to be. Have you ever had bad? I mean, you've had bad neighbors, right? Like you just—it's not fun. It's not nice. It's not good. That'll be this kind of trust. We know we're taking care of each other. It's not just me and mine. It's us. Aren't we glad that God's not just me and mine, and He's looking out for the well-being of other people? Okay, Amos. So what's the principle? What would you say is the principle of verses 1 through 4? What kind of character is God trying to instill in His people? It's a good question.
Love each other.
Yeah. Be loving, be kind. So let's say on the off chance, lion comes out and attacks the donkey while you bring it back. You beat the lion away, but then the donkey bleeds out and dies. What's the most kind thing you can do? There are probably several options you could arrange for, but do the kind thing to help your neighbor out. Don't just look out for your own interests, but for the interests of others. Count others as more significant than yourself, right? Philippians chapter 2. Same principle. Notice that God is not giving thousands and thousands and thousands of instructions. In this scenario, do this. In this scenario, but if it's a Tuesday, then, like, He's not doing that. It is generalities to help us to think through and reason through, how do I love these people?
I was just going to point out that you casually said beat the lion away as if it's not a lion.
No big deal. Yeah, you just do it because it's the kind of thing to do. Okay, Noah.
But that happens.
Sure, yes.
On Mishnah.
Yes.
They write these volumes and volumes and volumes of exposition on.
And it takes the focus away from, I'm trusting God to lead me to love, and now the focus is on the law, and I can do it myself. We're depending on a God who is loving and kind. Meredith? Good. Okay. All right. That's, I thought, is pretty simple, verses 1 through 4. Verse 5 is interesting. A woman should not wear a man's garment, nor man put on a woman's garment. So, women can't wear blue jeans? I don't think that's the idea here. You can push back on that if you want to. What is the principle here? What is the point? Because, again, if we're saying that we're under this law specifically today, then we're also talking about hybrid farming in verse 9. We're talking about wearing tassels on our garments in verse 12. Anybody wearing cotton and polyester in the same garment today? I mean, that's just super duper common. That's not what we're getting at here. But there's a principle, even a new covenant principle, that should be applied. What are we looking at here, Amos?
I think that with the woman wearing the man's garment and the man wearing the woman's garment, I think that there's something with lying or disguising yourself in that. Like
maybe so. What else? What is the principle? Which, by the way, that sort of thing could happen today. A kind of disguise and lying about reality and truth through wearing other garments. But what is the principle here, do you think?
Is it the idea that men and women are supposed to be distinct and separate?
Didn't God make them male and female from the beginning? Aren't they different? God expects us to rejoice in the distinctions between men and women? I think that's fairly simple. I don't know, you have other thoughts about that?
Well, first I want to start saying, I really don't know what all that means. I do know that is of the old agreement.
Sure.
But the present day application, I'm not sure, but also know that we're reading in between the lines on those.
Yeah, we are.
You know, God said this, did he mean that?
Yeah. But throughout the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, we're seeing that God distinguishes between the genders. And we may think that gender confusion is sort of a modern thing. It is not. It's really not. Gender confusion, like what does it mean to be male? What does it mean to be female? Well, if we're made in God's image, then we should expect to be able to look to God's character to see what it means to be male and female. But in a world that has dismissed the idea of God as just some idea, then don't be surprised when gender confusion becomes the norm and we begin to make up our own ideas. Now, again, I don't know that the clothing here is exactly getting at that, but that at least is a possible application from this. David?
Right, because I also think there might be something that is related to the roles that men and women have and the clothes that they wear as they go about, living out their roles, especially when you think of just, work and labor and things like that, what the men have to wear versus, what the women wear.
Absolutely.
When they go about their business. God doesn't want those lines to be blurred.
Yeah, there may be some overlap in the kind of work that's being done, but generally speaking, yeah, I think you're right. You're going to see men doing a certain kind of work, women doing another kind of work, and they're complementary. David?
I'm just thinking, but part of this is somewhat, or a lot of this is just how you define what is a woman's clothing and what is a man's clothing is somewhat cultural, and if we go back and look at the type of clothing they're wearing,
the dress.
Some ways, this discussion is defined by our culture and what we look at as, but definitely Christians don't need to be the ones pushing the boundaries. To make new definitions. We need to celebrate the differences, like you said, and celebrate femininity and celebrate masculinity and make sure that we understand the difference.
An illustration, blurring the differences. I've not shaved in a couple days. Would you say I have a beard? Thank you, Grace. Grace is no, not even possible. I have a hard time growing facial hair. Now, this is not a beard. Mike, you'd agree, right? Okay. My daughter would say, ooh, Daddy, you need to shave your beard. All right. Some of this is subjective, yes? Now, I may have no intention of growing a beard, but if I don't shave for a month, can I say it's not a beard anymore? So I might say, well, I didn't mean to grow a beard, but whether I meant to or not. So the question is, when is a beard a beard? And that may seem super silly to you, but that question has helped me think through some of this. We might say, well, that's not, but that is. And somewhere along the line, we've crossed a line. So we might say, when is a woman's garment not a woman's garment anymore? When is a man's garment not a man's garment anymore? When is a woman not doing a woman's role, man's role? And you might say, well, look, there's some room for discernment here. But at some point, you've got to say, look, we've crossed the line. That is what it is. And make a judgment on that. That may seem super silly. If it doesn't make sense to you, throw it out. Ignore that. But I found that idea to be helpful. Okay. The bird's nest in the tree. God's practicing, he's expecting his people to practice good husbandry. They enjoy the fruit of the land, enjoy what's coming. There's opportunity here, but not to the point of abusing and destroying what God had given them here. So you find a mother with her young. You can take the young from the nest, but you don't take the mother at the same time. There's just a kind of maintenance of the land. Verse 8, a parapet on your roof. And to David's point, David Ray's point, if we think modern day, we're maybe missing it some. Maybe not so much in Philly. There's a parapet on the roof over there. We have a sloped roof. Nobody goes up on my roof. But a lot of the roofs around here, you can go up and have a rooftop party if you want to. You need a parapet. Because you didn't mean for the guy to fall and die, but prevention of harm, okay? So you are responsible for caring for other people. You're responsible for his ox, for his donkey, and for him falling off your roof. You better be careful. 9 through 11, planting seed, cloth made of different threads. What in the world is happening here? Noah?
I can't speak for a couple of other ones, but the one I can kind of do some FYI about the oxen and the donkey being yoked together. The yoking of the harnessing of both these animals is totally different. The oxen pushes with his shoulders, so you got that little thing that comes down around and the bar up here, so they're pushing from up down here.
Right.
A horse or a donkey, they bridle, they're pushing with their chest.
Right.
If you put them two together in either one of those things, one of them is going to suffer, and it's not going to be good.
Okay.
So
okay.
It's unevenly yoked as another term.
Yeah. So there's a practical concern there, yoked. Perhaps. I think so, yeah. There's a mixing. And I think we could maybe come up with some practical reasons here about crops and the horses and the oxen and donkeys and things. Just like we could come up with practical reasons why not eating lobster is a good idea. There might be health benefits to that. But the point is there's some kind of spiritual application and a daily habitual reminder to the people. We don't do that. Why? Because we're God's people. Well, what does that mean? It means that we're pure. And it's just a, why unleavened bread? Why fruit of the vine? Well, there are pictures and there are things that are meant to come into the mind and help us to move in that direction in our character. So I don't have a great answer for all the practicals. There don't even have to be any practicals. It could just be God saying, do it this way because I'm God and I want you to learn something. And I think purity is really what we're getting at here. There shouldn't be a mixing. Lee, you had a thought? I think some of that is definitely going to be the case, and I think we've seen that before about like cutting the hair and tattoos and things like that. Some of that may be the case here. I'm hesitant to jump to that too quickly just because we can begin to kind of dismiss things based off culture and history, but I think where the evidence is there, the archaeology is there, you know, that's there. Let's talk about that. Paul in 1 Corinthians, he uses an Old Testament passage about not muzzling the ox while it threshes the grain. Remember what Paul says about that?
Worker is worthy of his wages.
And he says, is it oxen that God's concerned with? I mean, you might say, well, yeah, Paul. But is it just oxen he's concerned with? The point is, he's using that as something that's supposed to shape their character. So if I make sure the ox can eat grain while it's threshing the grain, then what should I do for my servant who's out here working? Pay him. Okay, so if I'm concerned about what threads my garment is made of, then shouldn't I be concerned about who I give my daughter into marriage? Really concerned about the threads of my garment, but you can go marry anybody you want to. I can go watch whatever movie I want to watch and go listen to whatever kind of music I want to listen to. Okay, you're concerned about your threads, but you're not concerned about your heart. Okay, so I think the character is what we're getting at here. Take one more, then we better stop.
Another overall theme may be general commission. Whether you understand it or not, are you willing to submit?
God said it, better do it. Okay, yeah. Amen to that, and then we'll stop there. There'll be a class next Sunday, Lord willing. We won't be here. Appreciate your prayers for our efforts in Nashville, Tennessee. But thank you for the discussion today.